But just thinking more broadly again, now obviously people listening to this podcast will be from a mix of ethnicities. Many like me will be white. How would you respond to someone who said, look, I'm white. I totally get white privilege, not in denial, realize that it exists, almost impossible to argue against it. But I didn't ask for it. I don't deny that I've benefited from it. But what should I do? How can I be a part of the solution? I never wanted to be a part of the problem, but I realize I am. How can I be a part of the solution? How would you help that person? I mean, not do their thinking for them, that would be wrong, but how would you help someone like me who's in that place?
It's really interesting to see how a number of white people have kind of woken up to or been awakened to the reality of racism, and more specifically, anti-blackness in the Western world. And how many have, I guess, been drawn into a space of guilt, but also are drawn into a space where, like you've highlighted, they want to actively become part of the change. And I think that in itself is hopeful, because what we don't want is a context where we all retreat behind fortifications and kind of stop engaging with one another. But we want to create a space that is mutually owned, that is mutually shared. But as we do so, we also want to recognize that we enter in that space not with the same history, not with the same legacy. Some of us bring centuries of privilege, and others bring centuries of oppression. And I think simply naming in that space the reality of our legacies and our heritage will be helpful. And my encouragement to those white people who want to do this work is to spend time reading the plethora of literature that is there. Either redefining history or helping them rethinking whiteness in the context of a decolonized history, but also not just be kind of trapped in a place of guilt, but recognizing that they will be the key artisans in building a tomorrow society. And I often say that in the same way as the struggle against patriarchy can only be won when men decide to do the work, the struggle against racism will only be won when white people will be willing to do the hard work.
Yes, I would certainly add to that. I think that developing a greater awareness is essential for thinking about how one might be able to begin to dismantle systems of institutional racism. But we can also learn from those who have gone before. You can think about those individuals who were against the slave trade and didn't wish to be part of it. You can think about individuals during Nazi Germany or apartheid in South Africa. There have been many instances where you've had an oppression at the societal level, and individuals have had to act to work actively against it. We need to inform ourselves and then start to commence on a program, a model of change, of dismantling the ideologies, dismantling the behaviors, dismantling the systems which oppress people purely on the basis of their skin colour.
And you talk there about change. I think Lusa mentioned about it's not advantageous to just retain the sense of guilt and kind of leave it sat with people unexpiated and nothing to do with it and stuff. I suppose the question I've got, when we look at Britain today, what we see still isn't great. Lots of statistics, etc., exist and abound around that link between ethnicity and poverty. Very topically, we know that BAME communities, for instance, have been disproportionately affected by COVID. there are all kinds of problems that are still very much around. But where's the balance between saying we've come a long way in the right direction and also saying, but we've still got a heck of a long way to go? I mean, now, I was a kid in the 1970s. My grandparents' generation were probably almost universally deeply racist. My parents can still remember Empire Day when they were at school. I remember the National Front being much more mainstream than, say, Britain First or the EDL are today. I remember the Brixton race riots. I went to football matches as a teenager every Saturday as recently as the 1980s, where thousands of people would boo or make monkey noises every time a black player touched the ball. You know, that's so recent. How do we celebrate the progress while absolutely guarding against complacency and mourning and addressing the distance we've still got left to travel? How do we hold those two together?
It's always intriguing for me to hear those arguments. And I hear them, in fact, from black people as much as I hear them from white people, but perhaps more so from white people. And I think, yes, we have come a long way. And it is true that when I was growing up as a teenager, it wasn't uncommon to be insulted and spat upon and have visual and primary expressions of racism leveled against me. But as I grow up, what I noticed is that racism in some way has gone underground, or rather it has become sophisticated. It's not crass in the same way as what we often denounce or had denounced and experienced even a decade or so ago. But it doesn't hurt less. So, and I was talking, in fact, recently with a group of friends. And we were saying that we would rather be dealing with that in-your-face primary racism than the subtle expressions of racism that are like a thousand cuts that affects and hit you deep at a soul level, and where you can't quite have the same ability to expose it and call it out, because it will often be denied and rejected. And so while, yes, we've come a long way, the experience of racism is still an ubiquitous experience for many of us. And I don't think we ought to congratulate ourselves and be satisfied with how long we've come. In some ways, the destination in this case matters more than the journey that we've traveled. And I often wonder, who does this statement serves more? It certainly does not serve me when every day I need to deal with expression of racism. It doesn't make the pain of it less. And the only commitment that we have to work for is to eradicate racism in all its expressions, so that my children won't have to deal with the reality of racism. And in fact, your children won't have to contend with the expression of racism as well, because ultimately racism is not just affecting black people or people from the global majority. It impoverishes all of us, and it robs all of us of the possibility of living full and mutually flourishing lives.
Yeah, it's a poison for the whole of society. And I'm interested in what you said there about the kind of the new racism, which is a subtle racism. What can you give us any idea? I mean, I suppose some of it is about apparent glass ceilings and representation at various levels of influence across society. But what else might that more subtle racism that you discern now, what might it look like? How might we be able to recognize it?
Well, I don't know whether you've ever come across expressions that or statements that end with "for a black man," and I imagine that all of us have heard those. So you are this, or you aren't this, for a black man, and just that assumption that blackness is often defined and perceived as negatively. And when one of us does something that kind of fit in white expectations, therefore there's an acceptability that is conferred to us. And yet that is done with the caveat and the qualifier that we are still black men or women. And in some ways, the worth of what we do is defined first and foremost in light of our ethnicity and our skin color. And it's just those everyday objectifying expressions and the fact that we are reduced to being our skin color or to being our ethnic group, not given the privilege of being who we are for the sake of who we are. And I think for me as a black man, and it sounds a bit like a cliche, but just the encounters with police force that have often been dehumanizing and humiliating. And I don't really want to go through details of that. But interestingly enough, I'm married to a white woman who, until she met me, had never been stopped by police. And since then, I can share instances of that happening to her. And that wasn't a coincidence, but simply an expression of her sharing her life with a black man in a world that is essentially predicated to serving the interest of whiteness.
Mm. I mean, that sort of language of "for a black man," I know that kind of presents blackness as a deficiency and kind of sees some people as the exception to some kind of a rule. I mean, that's really quite insidious, isn't it?
It is. And it is that, as you clearly and rightly state, that that assumption that whiteness is normative and whiteness is elevated to an absolute level. And Suzanne was talking earlier about the underpinning philosophy that supports the ideology of racism, which is rooted in that same mindset, suggesting that there is a hierarchy of worth and a hierarchy of value, and being black is certainly the least expression of humanity. And therefore, when a black person does something that is acceptable to our white sensitivities, then we recognize that as an exceptional expression of black identity or black expression. And in fact, we use that to the credit of whiteness, and white identity, and reinforcing, the deficiency, in our mind, and in our understanding of blackness.
And do you think sometimes almost as a survival mechanism that some people from black communities end up colluding with that? And I'm just thinking of taking it into a different sort of or drawing a parallel with something different. There was that early 20th century book called The Ragged Trousers of Philanthropists, where the main point of the book was that it was the sort of the working man who actually colluded with and acted philanthropically towards the people from the upper classes who were oppressing them. Is there sometimes a temptation almost for the sake of survival within black communities to collude with a system which is working against, which is working against their community?
I wouldn't call it colluding. I think what we have to recognise is that when you have a system which embodies privileges for some and disadvantages for others, it's internalised. So if you're repeatedly told that you're not worth the same as someone else, you begin to believe it. And this is the same in many areas, not just that of racial equality. So we find that, and you'll often hear in common discourses about the need to decolonize the mind, is the term that's quite often used within academic speech, and particularly within a lot of African literature. There's a need to decolonize the way in which we as people with African heritage think about ourselves, and which is, I think, the Black Lives Matter is a really important part of that process in terms of the reprogramming that actually, yes, those Black lives do matter. Yes, we are equal. Yes, we deserve the same level of respect and dignity. So it's not a matter of thinking about it's colluding with the system, but just over hundreds of years being on the receiving end of messages which have demoted, which have denigrated, which have placed Black ethnicity at the bottom of the social hierarchy. There is work to be done in terms of liberating individuals' minds to recognize, actually, no, we don't have to internalize these societal narratives at all. And there is equality for us as we are who we are, created by God.
Right. So it's almost the accumulated weight of living under those false narratives for years can almost lead people out of a sense of weariness almost to buy into the lie, which is tragic.
Absolutely. There's much research which is happening at the moment to do with intergenerational trauma. And it's part of that, how children who have been born to individuals who've gone through massive experience of trauma, that child can be traumatized by it, even though they themselves didn't experience it. And once again, we see that not just with racism, but children who parents went through the concentration camps Eastern Europe during the Second World War. So there's lots of work out there which does lead us to believe that it's possible to be traumatized, and it's possible to internalize those negative stereotypical tropes which are spoken about us.
This is such important stuff. Let's do a little bit of theology now. What would a theology of race look like to you? And why is racism not even an option for anyone who wants to be a follower of Jesus? Kind of two questions in one there. But what would a theology of race kind of look like?
Well, I wonder whether we should start by debunking the notion of race and perhaps then depart from any theology that wants to argue kind of fracture in human identity. And I think the Bible is beautifully bookended by expression of the human story that are defined as in the ultimate expression when they are in relationship with each other and in relationship with God. And we might argue also in healthy and life-giving relationship with self. And so the narrative of creation itself depicts humanity created plural. And therefore, the expression of that humanity then is aimed to kind of flourish and expand in the midst of creation in a way that celebrate that plurality of human identity. And I love that, I don't love the story, but I love the question that emerges out of the story of Cain and his brother Abel. So after the murder of Abel by his brother, God engages in conversation with Cain and asks him about where his brother is. And Cain responds with a question, which is, I'm always fascinated that it is the very first question asked by a human being in the whole of the Bible. And perhaps the rest of the Bible being written as an attempt to answer that question, am I my brother's keeper? And to me, that in many ways is a really key point as we try to define a theology, not of race, but a theology of human interaction and human relationship. So am I my brother's keeper? Am I my sister's keeper? And the question is rhetorical in many ways, because we know the answer to be yes. And then at the end of our Bible, in the book of Revelation, we have that vision of humanity gathered in worship before God. And I'm struck by the fact that it isn't just the reference of humanity gathered in worship before God, but it's broken down in ethnicity, in language, and so on. A way of saying that some of those categories are important for us to bear in mind, that we can't just be colorblind, we can't just ignore some of the factors that define us, but we engage with them in a way that speak anew the story of God and his relationship with humanity, and where we speak anew the story of humanity and the way in which it relates with itself.
Yeah. So, absolutely. I think I would just add to that in terms of understanding it, not so much as of race, but rather in terms of perhaps ethnicity. I would look to the book of Ephesians, which I think is really where that translation of that glimpse of heaven, of what it looks like with the people from every tribe, every nation, every language worshipping collectively together before God. How does that get translated through the church? And I think we find some of that answer in the book of Ephesians, where Paul quite clearly writes to his audience that there's reconciliation in Christ, not just to God, our Father, our Creator, but also reconciliation for humanity. Those divisions which once so characterized society, whether Jew or Gentile, male or female, slave or free, they are no longer the constituent parts of who we are once we transition into Christ and our identities become those of ones in Christ. So that reconciliation, which I think is a really beautiful piece for us to take away with in terms of our message, is central to the church, and it is central to our Christianity. The church is built on it. Reconciliation to God, our Creator, and reconciliation of humanity.
Yeah, I mean, that Ephesians passage is lovely, isn't it? Where it kind of provides a Christological solution. And that's the one, isn't it, where it talks about the dividing wall being dismantled. So yeah. I'm just thinking, when Luther was speaking, and he was obviously taking us into early Genesis and primeval theological history and all that kind of thing, I was thinking about the story of the Tower of Babel and wondering where that might come into it, and where some of those divisions between different groupings of people in that story kind of illustrative of their desire to usurp the place of God, and whether that's of interest in this kind of conversation.
Well, I wonder whether it is more than just an attempt to usurp the place of God, but what ultimately causes the demise of the community of Babel is the willingness to be to narrow human experience through one language, one identity, one culture, without recognizing the blessing of difference. And the challenge at Babel wasn't diversity, but it was the unwillingness to treat diversity as a gift. And interestingly enough, I haven't read the text recently, but I think in the Hebrew, one of the words that is used is that they didn't we often translate it as they couldn't understand each other, but actually there is an element in it, and I need to look at it, so don't quote me on that, but an element that suggests that the reason they didn't understand each other is because they did not listen to each other, they didn't pay attention to each other. And I wonder whether that is part of the challenge for us today, and the challenge of the sin of racism, which is that we fail to pay attention to each other and to pay attention to our differences as a gift from God. And therefore, our preoccupation becomes our fear, our fear becomes our preoccupation, and our fear becomes our demise. Perhaps in the same way as if we look at the narrative of the Exodus, or rather that bit when Moses comes and challenges Pharaoh, ultimately it is Pharaoh's fear that causes him to persecute the Hebrews. And it is that same fear that causes him to objectify them and enslave them. And I wonder whether there is perhaps an invitation for us to consider not fear as the driving force for us, instead look at our hopes and those pictures, the compelling visions of the future that draws us all together in reconciliation with self, the other, and God, and maybe use those as a framework through which we start dreaming and living the church.
Right. So, I just listened to so many things you said. We could get into loads of them, and we haven't got time. Really interesting that take on Babel, where perhaps the problem you're suggesting is not that they couldn't, but that they wouldn't. And interesting the way kind of you both took it away from a theology of race in inverted commas and brought it much more into that space of an adequate an exciting biblical anthropology. Where does the whole Imago Dei sort of image of God thing speak into our understanding of who we are, including ethnicity, etc.?
Well, I think that that's our starting point, isn't it? The recognition that we are made in the image of God, that we are one humanity, one people, one race, and we're made in the image of God. And as a result of that, we are equal and worthy of the same respect and dignity. I think in terms of the story of Babel, one of the, I suppose, potential meanings I always derive from that story is the fact that our languages and our cultures are God-given. For whatever reason that may be. I know in some of the literature, it's that it was the fulfillment of what God has said, go forth and multiply. The earth is yours, move forward, enjoy it. You don't all have to be concentrated in the same zone doing exactly the same thing. Progress. So from my perspective, it's very much about recognizing the fulfillment of what God had decided for humanity in full recognition that we are all made in his image.
And I also think that there's a point of caution because, you know, we go and walk in churches that often have got beautiful iconography, either through stained glass windows or sculptures that we see around us. And often those iconography speak of a particular contextual and cultural narrative that makes some assumptions about the people who come in that place, but also some assumptions about God. And so when we talk about being made in the image of God, we ought to be humble to recognize also that sometimes the vision that we have of who God is more in our image rather than in an absolute neutral expression of who God may be. And so when we talk about being made in God's image, we need to be mindful of the fact that we often read that and hear it very, very differently. And I think we have grown up and lived in a world that has define God along ideals of whiteness, not just in the way we depicted and represented God, but also in some of the attributes we've often assigned to God. And therefore, we need to do a work of decolonizing our thinking before we can enter the conversation around being made in God's image in a way that is not too heavily charged with cultural assumptions that ultimately become unhelpful. I often like a translation that suggests not being made in God's image, but also in God's imagination. And I think that frees us a little from the tyranny of cultural imperialism and offers us an opportunity to be creative with the way in which we speak God and the way in which we live God.
So I mean, I guess it was a few years ago now, you hear it less now, but for a while it was quite kind of fashionable and thought to be quite progressive to claim to be colorblind. You know, I don't see color. Now, on one level, I'm not sure that's even possible. But even if it were, would it be desirable, or does it actually? And I think you've implied, both of you in your previous answers, but, you know, does it actually just miss the point?
I think it misses the point. The reason being that it doesn't acknowledge the previous injustices and disadvantages which those from minority ethnic groups have experienced. If we just say, if we just, I suppose, attempt to say, well, now we're going to be colorblind without dismantling those structures of discrimination, the reality is we will continue to experience those same issues, that same, the same level of discrimination, because we haven't done anything to dismantle them. So it is incumbent upon us, it's imperative that we actually don't assume a colorblind approach in order to dismantle those structures in society which discriminate, which provide privileges for some and harm others first, before you could even feasibly say, oh, now we're in a position where we can adopt a colorblind approach.
That's really helpful, because actually effectively almost what you're suggesting there is that to say I'm colorblind is to race way too quickly to letting yourself off the hook and to creating a blank sheet and forgetting the past. And so we have to go through that process of recognizing color in order to own and understand where the sin's been in the past and how it's still, its tentacles still reach into the present. So that's really, really useful. And I guess the other problem almost is that, because I was really struck with that answer Lusa gave earlier about for a black man. And actually, if we say, oh, I'm colorblind, we actually aren't attacking that kind of thinking that says there's some sort of implicit deficit in being black. Actually, whatever color, whatever ethnicity we are, in some sense, that is representing something glorious about what it means to be made in the image of God. And to be colorblind is actually to miss a part of what God's gifted us with.
Yes, and I wonder whether colorblind, or I think I can't remember who it was who say, you know, if you can't see my color, you can't see me at all. If you're colorblind, you're wholly blind to who I am and my history, my heritage, but also my pain and my hopes. And I think what colorblindness often fails to recognize is the implicit assumption of the one stating colorblindness seeing themselves as normative. And therefore, I don't see your color, I see you like myself. I don't see you as black. Therefore, I assume that you are like me. And therefore, me being set as the norm. And language is really important. And the terminology that we use, the words we use to define ourselves and to speak of others are really crucial, because they are laden with value. And also they determine ultimately our attitudes and behavior. And ultimately, they shape the cultures that we live in. And I think speaking of colorblindness is not dissimilar to the language, you know, of referring to people from the global majority as non-white, as if non-whiteness can be in the same way as a man can't be a non-woman or a woman a non-man. There is something about suppressing the identity of the other by denying the reality of who they are. The challenge is not so much about not calling you what I think you are, but the challenge is for me to use a language that affirm your identity rather than debase who you are in both the verbal language that I use and the structural and institutional and cultural language that we create.
And language, I mean, interesting the way you brought out there language and the way that language is loaded. And sometimes even when we don't realize it, there are connotations to the ways in which we use words, and they carry meanings, not just the ones that we choose to give them, etc. Or maybe that's another debate. But I'm just thinking, how do we create conversational and learning spaces that are not only safe, or perhaps that aren't even safe? Perhaps sometimes we race to safety too quickly. But how do we create conversational and learning spaces? And I'm conscious of the fact that I myself, in this conversation we're having, that I'm very much in the place of learner. You know, I'm asking the questions partly because I actually really want to get the answers, as well as I want to make a podcast. So how do we create learning spaces that are not only safe, but that are also brave?
I think we need to recognize the need for the safe space as well, especially against the backdrop of centuries of exclusion, of violence, of abuse. Recognize that Black bodies have not always been in a place where they felt safe to articulate expressions of their pain and their hopes. And so they need a space where they can express their frustration, their pains, and without being questioned, without being challenged, without their truth being unbelieved. But we can't just rely on the safe space, because ultimately what we want is in the encounter that will allow us in conversation and exchange to build those societies and communities that will allow exchanges that will enrich all of us. Perhaps part of it is also borrow from the wisdom and experience of other cultures and communities that traditionally have been able to create spaces where difference of opinion and experience, where contentions in views were confronted together in a way that wasn't just driven by outcome, but ultimately by the ability of socializing or re-socializing those individuals who felt marginalized or excluded or aggrieved by a given process. I know in my own culture and tradition, we have had traditionally what we call in French, palabre. I know in English it has a bit more of a negative connotation, but palabre were the opportunity of gathering the community, often in a circle, where all voices would be given the opportunity to speak their truth and their truth to be heard. And ultimately, it wasn't just about getting an outcome that would be measurable and monitored, but ultimately it was creating a space where human stories and human life would intersect with each other and enrich each other. And out of that process, community was built and community was sustained. And I wonder whether there is something of that we need to develop within our context.
I would agree with that, Lisa. I think it is definitely an area where we can learn from those who have covered this territory before us. I think about the systems of truth and reconciliation that went through in South Africa, similar process in Canada, as a means of actually creating a space whereby individuals are able to share their stories, their victimization, their hurt, their discrimination, where others are engaged in active listening as part of that healing process. And as a result of going through that, being able to create spaces of reconciliation on the basis of that truth, on the basis of repentance. And I think that would very much help us in terms of moving forward. And I think that's the sort of brave space I would certainly be looking to help facilitate and create.
And is there within that the permission to get things wrong on your way to getting things right? That as you kind of almost perhaps almost externally process, and you're trying to, perhaps if you're someone from the, a white person in a predominantly white culture, and you're beginning to question the assumptions that you've been given and all the rest of it, as you verbalize some of that, you may be clumsily kind of working your way towards getting into a good place. Is there permission to be gently corrected when you get things wrong on your way to getting things right?
Yeah, I've been, I don't know whether I'm using is the right word, but certainly puzzled by white anxiety of saying the wrong thing, in the same way as white people seem to often be more concerned by being perceived as not being racist, irrespective of whether what they say or what they do is blatantly racist, and equally, I think there's a fear of being heard to say the wrong thing. Mm-hmm. I think I probably should talk just for myself and not for every black person. I am less anxious about people saying the right or the wrong thing. What I'm really concerned about is our willingness and our commitment to create the right structure, the right context, where we can tell and live the right stories. And perhaps my encouragement to white people is yes, do your work of educating yourself around the terminology and the language that you might use that is more affirming. But ultimately, don't be concerned by your own discomfort. Be more attentive to the needs of the other. And to the imperative of contributing to creating a just and fair society where all can flourish.
Yeah, so that's useful. So that actually there's a subtle shift there from oneself to the other. And a bit like, we would all probably interpret the Bible much better if we realized that it was a book about Jesus and not about us. There's that same thing, perhaps, as we enter these conversations, if we are someone who's been in the privileged white position, actually, it's not about me. It's about primarily other people, and that might be a kind of a head shift that would be really helpful.
Yes, absolutely. And my sense is that we probably need ultimately to be able to develop a language that and by language I also mean a culture that is redeemed from the legacy of whiteness. Because it is the legacy of whiteness that creates exploited and abused blackness. And so if we're able to not ignore it, but grow out of it, then we will not just free black people who are being victimized by that philosophy and that way of thinking, but we will also free white people who are as victim and as entrapped by that rhetoric and that philosophy as we are. And I believe that if we're able to dismantle then the architecture and the scaffolding of whiteness and white supremacy, both in its philosophical undergirding, then we will be able to enter into a space where white people will be less defensive about whiteness, and me as a black person will be less anxious about whiteness.
Coming towards an end now, just two last questions. One of them, I think it'd be really great to ask you both, what gives you hope as you look at society and at the church today? So what gives you hope? but also where do you find yourself still despairing?
I think for myself, what gives me hope is that we're now talking about it. It's no longer a peripheral subject, but it is out in the open and people are beginning to actively engage in discussion regarding what does this mean for me? What does this mean for the wider community? How does this translate for the church? Because I think once we start to openly discuss it, it moves us into a different territory of action. And that's what I find really exciting. We're able to articulate that there is a need for change and to move on now into and to occupy that space as to, well, how are we going to change it? And I find that really positive. In terms of the areas where I would still despair, I would say it's the amount of change, perhaps, and recognizing how much work is there to be done. We cannot underestimate the hundreds of years, the extent of the legacy that we're actually trying to overturn and how it's seeped into our ways of being, our thought, our systems. It's pervasive. It's completely pervasive. And so I still kind of take a deep breath when I think about what's going to be involved in actually decentering whiteness and actually creating a space which isn't imbued with that sort of cultural superiority. So I think for me, that's perhaps where I have my down moments and I kind of wonder about how we're actually going to manage it, but perhaps the answer is one step at a time.
Yeah, for me, I think a number of little things are giving me hope. This morning, my youngest child, who is not quite two yet, was repeating Black Lives Matter. Obviously, she's been hearing that from her siblings, from ourselves, and because it has saturated our lives recently, and so she's integrated that in her initial speech. Yes, Black Lives Matter, and it's important that even our children are able to say that. What gives me hope is a video that I watched this morning sent by our colleague Alison Booker, where her rural deanery in our diocese has put together a video where they wanted to offer a response following the death of George Floyd and all the protests that ensued. It's a context that is homogeneously white. It's a context that probably would see itself privileged at several levels, but it's a context that is wanting to engage with the global debate and the global conversation. It's a context that want to affirm their faith in a God who believes in the well-being and the flourishing of the whole of humanity. And yes, I am encouraged and I am hopeful when I see that. I am hopeful when I hear many of my white friends willing to enter in conversations, willing to ask the tough questions and to be asked the tough questions. And yes, I'm hopeful of seeing all the many signs and the many voices that are wanting to state loud and clear that Black lives do matter. But I'm going through all that with the reality that for the past few weeks, I've been struggling to sleep. I've been struggling to eat. And in fact, in the past 5 or 6 weeks, I've lost about 6-7 kilos. Obviously, I had a few excess kilos to lose, but I'd rather would have lost them in a different way. And that reminds me of the pain and the brutality of the experience of daily living with racism, and the reality of hopelessness. And I read recently that one of the signs and one of the expressions of hopelessness is loss of appetite. And I want to hold on to hope, but I find it difficult to hold on to at this time. And I hear the story of one of my daughter's friends. She's, I think, 8 or 9. She's white. Her parents have been sponsoring an African child, sending money for that child. And I think have been actively supporting that, and because they're committed Christians, have been also praying for that child and probably have been speaking to their children about that child. And a few weeks ago, that child turned to her parents and suggested that maybe they should also start sponsoring my daughter. And that saddened me, because I realized that this 8 or 9 year old white child has already integrated the structure of oppression, of whiteness. She has already integrated in her innocent mind that her whiteness somehow puts her in a privileged position compared to her black friend. And that saddens me, because I realize that the work that we've got to do is huge. We've lost the fight for our generation, and we're already losing the fight for our children's generation. And we need to wake up. We need to start changing the narrative. We need to start challenging the structures and the practices that keep rehearsing and reaffirming the narrative that suggests that whiteness is normative and whiteness is good, and that whiteness is superior. Unless we do that, our kids will be fighting the same battle. Our kids will be having the same conversations, and their children after them. And so I want to hold on to hope, but I find it difficult to hold on to.
Thank you both so much for the honesty of those answers. People who listen to the podcast regularly will know that normally at the end of a podcast, we put out a few suggested questions that you might want to take further on in your own discussions and conversations in your churches, or fresh expressions of church, or small groups, home groups, etc. We're not going to do that on this occasion, because this has been a longer and an extended podcast, because of really the complexity of the subject matter that we're looking at, and we've only kind of really scratched the very surface. But as we come towards a close, we obviously would like these conversations to be multiplying and to be taking place all around the diocese. But are there, for Lusa and Suzanne, are there any resources that you might suggest that would, or that might help either individual Christians or groups of Christians or churches together, help them to understand some of this stuff, help them to speak into some of the injustices that we're becoming more aware of as church in relation to race, broaden our understanding? Any resources quickly that you might both want to put out there and say this could be useful?
Well, perhaps I should start by saying that both Suzanne and myself are a diocesan resource made available to help our diocese to make sense of this and formulate strategies and practices that might help us to move towards a place that is more in tune with the vision that we've got of the kingdom and how we fit into it. More practically, I'm sure Suzanne will have a number of good literature or online resources to suggest. Is to say that for those who want kind of accessible and easy space to engage in conversation as a church community, there's a book that recently came out I've forgotten his name now, Ben Lindsay, called We Need to Talk About Race. And so Ben writes from his own experience and offers a really good opportunity for church communities to do some work, either individually and or collectively. I think that's a really accessible resource. And Ben himself is certainly available as well for anyone who would want to draw him in conversation. And in addition to that, there's a plethora of books written either from a faith perspective or from a secular perspective, and many written from a British perspective and others from an American perspective. And so from the British perspective, there's books such as Native by Akala, or British by Afua Hirsch. Why I no longer talk to white people about race, I think that's the title, I can't remember it, by Rainier Edo Lodge, and many other that could be really helpful as a starter for a deeper exploration.
Well, I think that there are a number of resources that you could turn to, whether that's from a biblical scriptural perspective or thinking about it more in terms of understanding historicities and cultures. Just to offer you a few suggestions, there's Gospel Reflections from the Mountaintop by John Perkins, which is really looking at issues to do with faith and religion within the American context, drawing on Martin Luther King. There's Diaspora, produced by the Lusant movement, as we know, part of the Anglican tradition, which is really thinking about how churches can embrace the migrant, locating it, contextualizing diaspora within a wider sort of like biblical narrative. A book by Aaron Chow and Amy Jackson on racism and how should Christians respond. Another one in terms of doing reconciliation, racism and reconciliation and transformation in the church and world by Alexander Venter. I think as well, it's quite important for us to think about a wider remit in terms of our literature. D'Angelo wrote Why Is It So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism? And some of the books which I have enjoyed reading in terms of understanding the experiences, the lived experiences of people from minority ethnic groups. For example, Andrea Levy's Small Island or Monica Ali's Brick Lane, published by Black Swan, a very accessible novels, literature, in terms of just beginning to place ourselves in the shoes of others who have had to walk and negotiate racism.
That's brilliant. Thank you both ever so much for those recommendations. Do have a look around and see how you can find resources which will help, that we can use to help educate ourselves as Christians, as followers of Jesus, as we think around some of these really vital and important issues. We've come to the end of our time together now, but as we continue to hold in front of us that wonderful vision that we find in the book of Revelation, of that great crowd gathered around the throne, comprised, as we're told, of those of every nation, tribe and tongue, let's keep talking, let's keep praying, let's keep working for justice. This has been Rethinking Aloud. It's good to think, it's good to talk, and I look forward to your company next Thursday when once again we'll be podcasting from the Diocese of Leicester. So thank you to Lucia and to Suzanne, and until our next podcast, stay safe and be blessed.